The latest airstrikes targeted the cities of Rafah, Khan Yunis and the Maghazi refugee camp. The Israeli army says it hit more than 400 targets overnight. According to Gaza's health ministry, the death toll in the besieged territory since October the 7th has surpassed 15,200. The number of wounded has also risen to 40,000. 70% of the victims are women and children. The Gaza Health Ministry says the regime forces have deliberately targeted 130 health facilities and put 20 hospitals out of service. It says hundreds of wounded are being treated on the ground. The head of the International Committee of the Red Cross has warned of the dire situation in the Gaza Strip, saying that lack of essential supplies is very concerning. Let's take a listen.
Everything in Gaza is at a breaking point. Civilians are displaced. Numbers of severely injured people who are waiting for treatment in hospitals that also are reaching a breaking point, where nurses and doctors have been working 24/7 with very limited resources. So, of course, we're doing everything we can to support the provision of healthcare. People are living in constant fear of violent death. People are struggling to survive with now, again, little food and water because of the resumption of the fighting. And in all likelihood, having aid getting inside Gaza will become automatically more challenging. So, it's a matter of grave concern to us. Well, we don't have precise reports, but what I can say is the resumption of fighting was intense again. And of course, it's a new layer of destruction coming on top of massive and unparalleled.
Human rights activist Firwaza Najim says the Israeli regime is targeting civilians and infrastructure in Gaza as a collective punishment for the Palestinians supporting Hamas.
This is called collective punishment. They are punishing the whole Palestinian nation, especially all the residents of Gaza, all the civilians in Gaza. Hitting bakeries and things like that obviously shows you they do not care for human life. They do not care about international law. And, The state of U.S. and the secretary there, Blinken, he went there and he gave them a green light to commit these crimes. You know, he just elaborated about him caring about the civilians and to minimize on killing the civilians and so on, or try as much as you can not to hit the civilians. But this is just a lame statement that has no credibility to it at all, because at the end of the day, civilians should never be attacked and killed in this fight. And we've seen the amount of civilians that are killed. We can say maybe 90% or 95% of the deaths inside Palestine are civilian deaths. So that shows you, when you put it into real terms, that it's a genocide. And that they're killing the people of Gaza, and they're collectively punishing them because they're not standing up against Hamas. Because the majority support Hamas, the majority support the resistance.
The Al-Qassam Brigades keeps up fighting invading Israeli forces in Gaza and launching retaliatory attacks against Israeli targets deep inside the occupied territories. In the latest attacks, Qassam fired a barrage of missiles at Tel Aviv, Ascalon and several other cities in response to the massacre of Palestinians in Gaza. The group also attacked Israeli troops, tanks and military vehicles in various parts of northern Gaza. The Qassam Brigades hit several gatherings of Israeli soldiers using the short-range Rajum missile system. Resistance forces also targeted an Israeli command center inside a building east of Beit Hanun with 4 anti-personnel shells. The regime's army says it has lost 75 soldiers since launching a ground invasion in Gaza. However, resistance groups say Israel is concealing the real number of its casualties. The Palestinian president has called for an immediate and complete cessation of Israeli aggression on Gaza during a meeting with the prosecutor of the International Criminal Court. Mahmoud Abbas urged Karim Khan to pursue legal actions against Israeli war crimes responsible for crimes committed in the occupied territories. He also called for the intensified efforts to provide more humanitarian aid water, electricity and fuel to Gaza. The ICC prosecutor also met activists and prisoners released from the Israeli prisons. On Friday, Khan met Israeli officials as part of his regional visit. Since October 7th, bakeries across the Gaza Strip have been one of the targets of Israeli airstrikes. Dozens of bakeries have been either bombed or have gone out of service due to lack of fuel. As the total siege imposed by Israel on the already blockaded territory continues, food is running out and bread is becoming more difficult to get each passing day. Now several residents in Gaza City have constructed a makeshift bakery from iron sheets and firewood to make bread. Let's take a look.
We were compelled to come here as there are no bakeries available. The people here who are our friends are baking bread to aid the community. Procuring flour is challenging for us, as a 20-kilogram bag costs around 300 to 400 shekels, which is a substantial amount. The people are suffering.
In response to the catastrophic situation in the Gaza Strip, particularly in the northern region, we thought of a way to serve our community. We crafted this handmade with iron sheets to provide bread for people and their children to help them survive and fulfill their needs after all basic necessities were cut off. We first offer the service to the people in return for a symbolic amount which helps cover the cost of the firewood we collect. However, our efforts and manpower are solely dedicated for the sake of God and our community. We are people, we are human and humane. We urge the international community to pay attention to our bereaved people, who have sacrificed more victims and martyrs in the pursuit of freedom. We call on them not to apply double standards, but to grant Palestinians their right to a normal life. We seek attention for our cause, so that Palestinian children can smile like children everywhere else in the world, rather than being slaughtered unlike any other place in the world.
Iran's president urges Japan, amongst other countries, to hold referendums on the Palestinian question to measure the level of public support for the oppressed nation. Ebrahim Raisi said Western countries are afraid of holding such referendums. He made the remark during a phone call with Japanese Prime Minister Fumio Kishida. Raisi described Israel's genocide in Gaza as the biggest humanitarian disaster of modern history. He also slammed the United States as the main supporter of the regime's war machine. Raisi said the amount of explosives Israel has dropped on Gaza is seven times the explosive force of the atomic bomb dropped on Hiroshima. He urged Kishida to use Japan's diplomatic capabilities to stop the bombing of Palestinians in Gaza. For his part, Kishida expressed concern about the humanitarian crisis in Gaza while emphasizing the need to stop attacks on civilians. Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian has called for an immediate end to Israel's attacks against Palestinians in Gaza. Amir Abdollahian made the remark during a phone call with the European Union Foreign Policy Chief Joseph Borrell. The Iranian top diplomat said the crisis in Gaza stems from Israeli occupation and aggression. Amir Abdollahian warned that the war could spread in the region if the regime's attacks on Gaza don't stop immediately. He said the U.S. support has emboldened the regime to carry out its massacre of civilians. Borrell, for his part, said the Palestine issue should be resolved or solved through diplomacy, adding that military attacks would only exacerbate the crisis. Meanwhile, pro-Palestinian rallies continue across the world to demand an end to Israel's brutal aggression against the besieged Gaza Strip.
It's important to be here today and to continue because it is not over. And the humanitarian pause was nothing. It was a joke. It was feeding people to bomb them. I mean, it's insane that it continues. And Israel has come out and said they were going to keep bombing for at least two more months. It's not okay. And we are here to say we are not going to let this happen, not under our watch.
In Paris, protesters waved Palestinian flags and chanted "We are all Palestinians" as they called for a ceasefire in Gaza. The demonstrators expressed support for the Palestinian resistance. They also demanded that the Israeli regime be brought to justice for its crimes against innocent people of Gaza. In Spain's capital, Madrid, protesters marched through the streets to call on the government to cut its relations with the Israeli regime. The rallies demanded an immediate halt to what they called the Israeli genocide in Gaza. In Germany, people gathered in the streets of Gesund Brunnen to show solidarity with the Palestinian people. A similar pro-Palestine rally was held in New Zealand.
Yeah, definitely. There's events worldwide happening right now. Protests all around the world, USA, Canada, Australia, all the worlds in the Arab region have also been protesting. Everyone wants a permanent ceasefire in Gaza, and we want a free Palestine as well.
I think that the whole concept of a pause in the first place is inhumane. So we're going to, you know, give you some time to recover, and then we're going to bomb and annihilate you again.
In Auckland, protesters called on the UN to take action and stop the Israeli aggression. They said a permanent ceasefire is of utmost importance in Gaza. Around 30 similar events were held across New Zealand. In the US, protesters gathered outside the White House to express solidarity with Palestinians. They called for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza.
With the participation of Palestinian Scout Associations and children under 16 years old, Palestinian resistance factions organized a rally this Saturday in front of the UNICEF headquarters in Damascus to show solidarity with the children in Gaza. This after the representatives of international organizations refused to accept the children's letter, pushing them to publicize their message instead.
The Israeli army deliberately bombed hospitals, including Al-Ahli, Al-Shifa, Al-Quds, and the Indonesian. All the hospitals were put out of service because of the Israeli and American warplanes that kill and mutilate bodies.
We demand UNICEF to fulfill its responsibilities in helping protect civilian infrastructure, such as schools, hospitals, and water stations, and to ensure the provision of basic medical and food supplies for Gaza's children.
The children staged a performance on the massacres committed by the Israeli regime against kids in Palestine. They also chanted slogans and carried banners condemning war crimes committed against children and demanded the removal of the blockade imposed on Gaza.
Palestinian children amidst the rubble remain steadfast in the path of resistance. We will not surrender and will only bow before God. The Palestinian child fully understands that resistance is the only and optimal choice for the liberation of Palestine.
We are here to support the children of Gaza. I will call on the United Nations to support them, provide milk to them, and to help us stop attacks on hospitals and schools as they are safe zones for children.
The children affirmed that future generations will increasingly embrace resistance as the sole path to reclaim their occupied lands and to restore their legitimate rights, especially after they have witnessed the total failure of the international community to stop the bloodshed in Gaza.
Every child in the world must have access to medical care, clean water, healthy food, and a safe environment. But the children of Gaza don't even know if they will live to see another day. Yet, with innocence and resilience, they resist the Israeli tyranny. Ibrahim Wahdib, Damascus.
The Hezbollah resistance movement hits Israeli military targets in retaliation for strikes on southern Lebanon. In a statement, the group said it targeted headquarters of the Israeli Army's 91st Division in Bir Anit, as well as a Jalal Alam military base. Hezbollah fighters also struck a gathering of Israeli soldiers with missiles. Hezbollah says the attack are in response to the regime's Friday bombing of southern Lebanon that led to the deaths of two civilians. Our correspondent Mariam Saleh earlier joined us and gave us the latest on the exchange of fire between the regime and Hezbollah.
Of course, there was a lot of clashes, at least four or five flare bombs, in addition to phosphorus bombs that were shelled in the outskirts, in the areas of Farkilak, Farshuba, and Khiyam. Of course, this basically shows that the Israelis are lying when they say they are not using white phosphorus bombs, which is considered illegal arms, in addition to the fact that they continued their shelling throughout and across the border area in and even areas that are close to civilians in Kfar-Shuba town specifically, which is not, it's not occupied, but it is right adjacent to the Kfar-Shuba hills that are occupied by the Israelis. Of course, they are using shelling from drones, they're using artillery fire and all sorts of weapons in addition to fighter jets, but that has not been used very much. And we have, of course, when it comes to the Hezbollah operations, we have several operations today, at least nine. If I can mention just a few, we started from the early hours of the morning, actually, from 11 a.m. There were direct targeting of areas which are the launching sites of the artillery fire that the Israelis use in order to shell the Lebanese towns, the bordering towns. And so Hezbollah made it clear to launch and hit and strike, of course, directly these launching areas. We also have another operation as well in the Mawqa of Ar-Rahib, and you also said the 91st Division, which was also today.
And with that, we come to the end of this bulletin. Thank you for being with us. Take care for now.
The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day, from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.ir/en. Now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
After weeks of continuous Israeli regime bombardment of Gaza, the real death toll is likely much higher than what has already been reported. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote, it took just one mention of the more than 15,000 Palestinians killed in the Zionist regime's war on Gaza for senior Netanyahu advisor Mark Regev to revert to the line that these are Hamas numbers. In a recent interview with Mehdi Hassan on MSNBC, Regev refused to acknowledge that the Zionist regime had killed children in its relentless and indiscriminate bombardment of the besieged Gaza Strip, suggesting that the hours of heart-wrenching footage aired daily could not be independently verified. It is true that over the weeks of war in Gaza, the process of gathering and verifying information and footage has become extremely difficult and sometimes impossible. But the primary reason for this is Israel's ongoing push to control the narrative. The Zionist regime has totally sealed off the territory, refusing to grant permission for foreign journalists to enter the war zone. At the same time, at least 53 media workers have been killed in the war since October 7th, making it the deadliest conflict for reporters since the Committee to Protect Journalists began collecting data in 1992. Sharif Abdul Quddus, an independent journalist who worked on an award-winning film about the Zionist regime's killing of Al Jazeera correspondent Shirin Abu Akleh in May 2022, said in an interview with Democracy Now!, "You have a situation where you're killing most of the registered journalists in Gaza, and you are not letting other journalists in." Nadim Hawri, executive director of the Paris-based Arab Reform Initiative, told Middle East Eye that Israel is deliberately seeking to control information flow from Gaza. He added, noting that the world is witnessing a full narrative war with Israel deploying its usual arsenal. It is also trying to influence coverage through deliberate misinformation. He compared the situation to the lead-up to the 2003 U.S.-led invasion of Iraq, when claims from the Bush administration were parroted by mainstream media without scrutiny. This had devastating consequences then, and this is having devastating consequences today. Journalists and media workers who aren't directly killed by the Zionist regime's shelling have been paralyzed by the devastation of communication networks due to ongoing bombardments and the absence of fuel and electricity. At the start of the war, the Zionist regime's war minister, Yoav Gallant, declared a full siege on the population of 2.3 million people in Gaza, citing a fight against human animals, as he claimed. Other journalists have lost their families in Israeli airstrikes on civilian structures, including Al Jazeera correspondent Wael Dahoudo, who received news of the killing of his wife, son, daughter, and grandson while live on air. Despite the Zionist regime's blackout on Gaza, the casualty numbers provided by local authorities and international organizations are widely seen as reliable, just as they have been in past wars. On rare occasions, the Zionist regime's military has allowed reporters from international news networks to embed with its troops in Gaza, on condition that they surrender their materials to Israeli authorities before publication. Mohammad Shahada, chief of communications at the Geneva-based Euromed Human Rights Monitor, told Middle East Eye, "Any journalist, foreign journalist, going into Gaza is going in on three conditions. Stick to Israeli tours, go where they want to go, and see what they want you to see." Journalists embedding with the Israeli regime troops have been barred from speaking with Palestinians, Shahada added, pointing to some of the international coverage of the siege of Ashrafa Hospital, which did not include Palestinian voices, even as thousands were sheltering inside the facility. The Zionist regime's chokehold on information from Gaza is just one aspect of its efforts to control the narrative. Israel's permanent representative to the United Nations, Gilad Erdan, has taken his government's campaign against Hamas numbers to another level. While sitting at the Security Council, Erdan recently launched a tirade of accusations against the UN itself, saying, "Every number from the so-called Ministry of Health is Hamas. Many UNRWA workers in Gaza are themselves members of Hamas," he claimed, adding, "The time has come to bust the myth of UN supplied facts." His comments weren't the least bit surprising. Since the beginning of this war, more than 100 UNRWA workers in Gaza have been killed in Israeli regime attacks, some of which have targeted schools turned shelters funded and operated by the agency. This is despite the fact that all the agency's staff in Gaza are vetted and their names shared with the Zionist regime, Julia Tuma, spokesperson for UNRWA, told the New York Times. Alessandro Accorsi, a senior analyst of technology and conflict with the International Crisis Group, told MEE that in past conflicts, while the Israeli regime army has been slow to release casualty figures, the data has more or less aligned with that of the Gaza Health Ministry. But the current war is different. As the tide of international public opinion shifts in favor of Palestinians, the international blank check the Zionist regime had at the beginning of the war to fight Hamas is running out. Of course, he said, "If Israel had to confirm the death toll now, this would give a big push to calls for a humanitarian ceasefire." Indeed, after weeks of continuous Israeli regime bombardment of Gaza, many analysts warn that the real death toll is likely much higher than what has already been reported, due to the near impossibility of tracking and documenting every case. Thousands of bodies are believed to still be trapped under the rubble, while others have likely been buried without official notice. What the Zionist regime calls Hamas numbers could indeed be wrong. Not because they are inflated, but because they do not capture the full extent of the horrifying reality on the ground in Gaza.
IRIB English Radio presents
Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. Well, welcome to another episode of the program Viewpoints. I am Atta, the host of this program. I have two very special guest speakers from the Islamic House of Qom to discuss today's topic, Brother Habib and Sheikh Rouhani. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh Rouhani. Welcome to Sheikh.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
And Brother Habib, assalamu alaikum to you.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Okay, for today's discussion, we want to talk about research projects on Shia Islam main orientations and frameworks. There are so many people in the world who are interested in know more about Shia Islam, where to start. Brother Habib, let's start with you, brother. Where to start if you want to study about Shia Islam?
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim, bismillahir rahmanir rahim. I think that the important factor to start when searching for Shia is to see the main difference of between Shiism and the different sects of Islam. How did Shiism start? Mm-hmm. When did it start? And from that beginning, you start to open doors to reading the history of the Imam alayhim as-salam, especially the history of Amir al-Mu'minin alayhi as-salam and his wife Fatima al-Zahra. You start to understand more than the movement, the movement of Imam Hassan, and then the tragic events of Karbala. How the A'im alayhum as-salam, from the sons and the descendants of Imam Hussein alayhi as-salam, dealt politically. and how the companions used to live. And I think one of the best books to recite or to read to understand the socialist aspect of the imamis is Rijal al-Kishi, Ikhtiyar Ma'rifat al-Rijal. You understand that the Shias were different even during the times of the Imam alayhim as-salam. There were tribes, the Imam alayhi as-salam would try to bring the Shia together, but still everyone had their own flag and banner they would follow. And also to look at the wisdoms and the knowledge that the Imam alayhim as-salam brought forward. After that, see how the Shias dealt with the occultation of the Imam Ajallah Ta'ala Faraj al-Sharif. How the Shias are dealing with this. What are the ideologies out there between the Shia Muslims? Because when you enter the Shia seminary, you will see a lot of different theories about the topics. And, you know, just reading them gets you to know the Shiaism, the roots of Shiaism. You know what compares them, what brings them together, and then what separates them.
Uh-huh. That's all right. Is it only limited to beliefs, Shaykh? Or no, for example, there are other perspectives, orientations inside the Shia Islam? And if somebody wants to be a Muslim, a Shia Muslim, what to do? You know, what are the guidelines?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. You know, if you want to know what Shia is or what the Shayu is, of course, you can study about different aspects or dimensions of the Shayu. For example, if you want to give some examples, first of all, as our brother rightly mentioned, the way that Shayu was developed was established after the demise of the Holy Prophet. So this, let's say, development of the Shayu or establishment of the Shayu by the Imam alayhi salatu wasalam and later by the students of the followers of the ulama and the scholars. So this is very much significant that how the school of the Shayu was made up, was developed, was, let's say, established by the scholars in the history of Islam. This is very much, this historical kind of background of the Shayu is very much important to be understood by the one who is going to study about the Shayu, because he should know that the main sources of the Shayu is authentic and it goes back to the teachings of the Holy Quran, teachings of the Prophet and the Ahlul Bayt. These are the founders of the Shayu. And then the other kind of aspect of studies about the Shayu is this, that we can study about the different groups of the people, societies, communities, or maybe nations that in the history they were Shia. And culturally, or for example, traditionally, we can study about their, let's say, population, their geographical locations, their history, their language, their culture, all these things. And then, of course, as you rightly mentioned, the belief, the main principal belief of the Shayu is also, again, important.
Yes.
That we should know. It is one of the aspects of the Shia studies.
Okay.
And then the main teachings or the main customs, traditions, conducts of the Shayu, they are all really, really important to be understood. So it is not only limited to the study about the belief of the Shayu.
Yes.
Of course, the history of the Shayu, it's anthropological studies, or let's say geographical studies, historical studies, social studies, political studies, all different aspects of the school of the Shayu can be studied.
That's right.
Then, of course, one can get a better understanding, better perception of the Shayu.
When a Western, for example, scholar gets into, for example, study Shiism, would he face a different world from the other worlds of the other Islamic sects, Brother Habib, or not?
Yes, he will.
He will?
Okay. He will. Okay. Because politics are different. The culture is different. The history of Shiaism, how it started, for example, in Medina, then moved all the way to Kufa, and how from Kufa it moved into, for example, Khorasan. And then from Khorasan, the capital, Baghdad, then Baghdad to Najaf, Najaf to Jabal Amil, Jabal Amil to Isfahan, Isfahan to Karbala, Karbala to Najaf again, now in Qom. The political, the geographical aspects of it are very different. The sects, the problems that they had, the types of scholars that they had, the influence that their scholars had. I mean, one of the most influential scholars I personally see, and also underrated, even though he is highly respected, Sheikh al-Baha'i. Highly regarded, highly influential person. He went to India, he went to Bahrain. He did not leave a place where he went to. He even went to Afghanistan. So these influential figures are different to the Sunni school of thought, because the Sunni school of thought their scholars are way different than ours. Mm-hmm. They have various sects inside theology. They have various sects inside jurisprudence.
Yes.
And they are a majority. And usually when there is a majority, it's going to be normal that people are different than minority, when you're a minority. Mm-hmm. So, and of course, the political rulers at the time, they played a role. For example, the Sunni capital for their seminaries, it was at one time in Egypt, at one time it was in Baghdad, and one time it was in Damascus, and another time it was in Kufa, and they had their own different geopolitical statuses and political statuses and whatnot, and their own influential figures, their own history. So when they enter Shi'ism, yes, they're going to see a different world.
So is, for example, the ups and downs more than the other Islamic sects, like Hanafis, like Shafi'is, or
It's normal. Like even during the time of the Imam alayhum salam, there was like these dark histories, notorious histories, and some of them were covered, some of them were not covered. And during the time of the Imam, so how about when there is no Imam? Mm-hmm. And it's like the saying of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam in Al-Kafi, that believers are like the sheep without the shepherd. Without the shepherd, the sheep get lost. Have you ever seen sheep? I've seen sheep a lot. You throw one to the right, all of them follow them to the right. You throw another one to the left, it goes to the left. But if you leave them still, everyone moves by themselves. They need a shepherd to tell them to make them safe, to keep them safe, to keep away any wolves, and to make them walk in a proper and orderly manner. So there might be some, you know, dark points in history. I could bring up a couple of examples. For example, Sayyid Muhammad al-Mujahid, the son of Sayyid Ali al-Tabatabai, Sahab al-Riyadh, Sahab al-Manahid al-Fiqh, and Mafatih al-Usul, great scholar in Karbala. There was the Persian-Russian war, where he granted a fatwa issuing that we must defend the lines of Persia, of Iran, between against the Russians.
Okay.
So he himself went to the war. Mm-hmm. People would take from the wudu, from the water of that was used by a Sayyid from ablution, and use it as tabarruk, to be blessed with that water. That was when he was going to the war. But after there was a political agreement between the Russians and the Persians, they fled back, the troops fled back, and only a Sayyid Mujahid and a couple of his, you know, people were left. And they got betrayed at the end of the day. So when they were returning, the same person that was followed for taking the water as a blessing was filled with saliva.
Saliva, that's right. Unfortunately.
So that's just one example that popped up to my mind right now.
That's right. How politics could change the face of Shia leader.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Sheikh Rouhani, so regarding the different scholastic studies, for example, fiqhi, kalami, Quranic, hadith, akhlaqi, would be also very much different from the other Islamic schools of thought or not?
You know, no, that much difference is from particularly from moral perspective. You know, if I focus on moral teachings are always the same, but the difference is the principles, or let's say the foundations, or the philosophy behind moral teachings.
Okay.
That makes different kind of views.
Jurisprudentially speaking, fiqhi,
majority of the fiqhi rulings or jurisprudential fatwas are the same. But of course, there are differences, maybe 20% or 10%. If according to some of the scholars, only 10% of fatwa and fiqhi fatwas are different among the madhahibs and different denominations. But most of them are like the same. For example, the same, we have salat as wajib for Shia and Sunni. Or, for example, Hajj is wajib.
Yes.
Paying alms is wajib. For example, paying khums is wajib. All these things are, jihad is wajib, for example. Okay. When it comes to the details, of course, how to perform salat, how to perform, for example, fasting, how to pay zakat, on what certain, for example, things we should pay zakat, to whom should we pay zakat, mm-hmm. how should we spend them.
Yes.
Yeah, and this kind of details, sometimes, of course, we see differences. But the main Islamic, let's say, ahkam are the same, yeah.
That's right. And the Shias are the are considered as the minorities in the Muslim
population.
Yeah,
in the history, it was minority, but nowadays...
Is it? We cannot say nowadays...
The number of the Shias is increasing in the whole world, yeah.
Okay, that's right. So some concepts like, for example, Imam As, or believing in Imam al-Mahdi as the occultation, has also attracted so many non-Muslims, or it's better to say... those people who believe in the concept of last Messiah or Messianism into the Shiite world. Could it be a nice point to reach out to the Shia one to find a commonality, common point, Brother Habib, or not?
The concept of Mahdiism, or the savior of mankind.
Yes.
The savior of mankind. It's, you know, scattered out there in various religions, yes. and various beliefs. Even Sunnis, the Sunni school of thought, there is the belief of Imam al-Mahdi.
But he's not born yet, they say.
They say he's not born yet. Okay. And that's the difference between us and them and the rest of the
school. Who is it going to be born from?
I don't know, but they say that he's a descendant from the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. They do have that belief. He's a Sayyid.
Okay.
He's a descendant of the Prophet. So it is, yes, important for those who are studying about the savior of mankind to research the Shia school of thought on this concept, on this thought, especially the books such as Kitab al-Ghaybah, Sheikh al-Tusi, Kitab al-Ghayb al-Sheikh al-Na'mani, Kamaluddin or Ikmaluddin, complied by Sheikh al-Saduq. It's very important to read why they comply the books. Uh-huh. It really opens the door on understanding the Shia school of thoughts or the ideologies that were available during that time, whether it be Sunna Shi'i or Shi'i Zaydi, because Ikmal al-Din was complied by Sheikh al-Saduq to debate the Zaydis.
Zaydis, that's right.
And especially the book of Sheikh al-Tusi, there are chapters about the representatives of the Imam and how some may use the concept of Mahdiism as a supermarket, as we like to call it, for their own good, for their self-interest.
As a tool.
Used by Ash-Shamaghani, for example, used by, I forgot the names, they had they had various beliefs and whatnot. Sheikh al-Tusi mentions them, states them. It's important to read that. And also, the history of the Qum Seminary. Especially the Qum Seminary. Why? Because it was like the capital at the time for the Shia scholars,
yes.
for knowledge. It was during the time of Ibn al-Walid. It was the time of Sheikh al-Kulayni, Sheikh al-Kulayni, for example, Muhammad ibn Ahmad, or Al-Ash'ari al-Qumi, for example, Zakariya ibn Adam. These figures were available in Qum at the time. They were the narrators, they were the scholars at the time, and the reading their history, reading the political history at the time, it also helps you understand the Shia school of thought, how it evolved, how it developed to what it is today, and how it has changed, the flaws in it, and the you know, the things that were fruitful during their development.
Okay. Thank you very much, Brother Habib and Sheikh Rouhani, for a nice elaboration regarding where to start if you want to study about Shia Islam. It was very kind of you. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstudy.ir, Call of Islam page. You can download for free our previous episodes of the program, Viewpoints, other episodes of other on other topics too. Till another episode, God bless you.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Viewpoints. Please don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.ir. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Gathered here with my family, my neighbors and my friends, standing firm together against oppression, holding hands. It doesn't matter where you're from, or if you're young or woman or man, we're here for the same reason. We want to take back our land. Oh God, thank you for giving us the strength to hold on, and now we're here together.
follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
In the limelight.
In the United States, Special Counsel Jack Smith has countered Donald Trump's attempts to wriggle out of the election subversion case. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The national broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. Special Counsel Jack Smith is rebutting attempts by former President Donald Trump to have the election-related indictment against him dismissed in Washington, D.C., according to court filings docketed on Monday, 6th of November. No other president has engaged in conspiracy and obstruction to overturn valid election results and illegitimately retain power, prosecutors wrote in a nearly 80-page document. The indictment squarely charges the defendant for his conduct, and the defendant's constitutional and statutory challenges to it are meritless. The special counsel Jack Smith was responding to a set of motions by Trump's legal team asking federal judge Tanya Chutkan to dismiss the four federal charges filed against the former president in Washington, D.C. earlier this year. Those charges included conspiracy to defraud the United States and conspiracy to obstruct Congress's certification of President Joe Biden's 2020 election victory. Donald Trump pleaded not guilty to all the charges and denied wrongdoing, while characterizing the case as politically motivated. Last month, Trump's lawyers argued that the former president was in part engaging in constitutionally protected speech during the conduct alleged in the indictment and his past Senate impeachment trial, which did not end in a conviction and therefore precluded further criminal prosecution. They wrote that the former president is a target of selective and vindictive prosecution and asked the court to strike allegations in the indictment related to actions at the Capitol on 6th of January 2021. But in Monday, 6th of November's court filings, prosecutors countered each of the claims, arguing Donald Trump used deceit, trickery, or dishonest means to push his scheme to defraud the United States after the 2020 election, based on accusations that Trump knowingly made false statements to the public and government officials. Any speech that the defendant used to carry out the conspiracy, fraud, and obstruction crimes charged in the indictment is categorically excluded from the protections of the First Amendment, prosecutors wrote. The special counsel's arguments on Monday included some of the most explicit references the prosecutor has made connecting Donald Trump to the U.S. Capitol siege, for which more than 1,100 people have been charged. Jack Smith alleged in his first filing that Donald Trump directed a large crowd to the Capitol on 6th of January 2021 and later exploited the violence. In his second court filing on Monday, 6th of November, the special counsel wrote that the 6th of January was the day that each of the defendants' criminal conspiracies came to a head and argued those events were included in the indictment because they provided necessary context for the criminal conduct with which he's charged. Jack Smith also emphasized Trump's ongoing support and championing of January 6 defendants, writing Trump has promoted and extolled the events of that day. While the violent attack was ongoing, the defendant told rioters that they were very special and that we love you. In the years since then, Jack Smith continued, Donald Trump has championed rioters as great patriots and proclaimed 6th of January 2021 as a beautiful day. In court filings and on his social media, the former president has alleged the case against him is politically motivated and meant to target him during the presidential election. But Jack Smith pushed back in another court filing on Monday, arguing the indictment is predicated on facts and law and not animus. This prosecution stands upon the bedrock principle of equal justice under law, the special counsel contended. The defendant's sweeping claims of selective and vindictive prosecution are unsupported by any evidence and lack any merit. Trump's attempts to dismiss the case are not his first. The former president is also urging Judge Tanya Chutkan to toss the indictment based on claims of presidential immunity, arguing he's shielded from prosecution because the actions described in the indictment occurred whilst he was president. The judge has yet to rule on that argument, but in the meantime, Donald Trump's defense team has asked her to pause the case until she issues an order. Trial in the case is currently set for March, and Jack Smith's team wrote in a separate court filing on Monday, 6th of November, that prosecutors opposed the requested stay in the case. American newspaper The Daily Beast has also covered the same story. Prosecutors in Donald Trump's Washington, D.C. election subversion trial filed a rebuttal against his request to dismiss charges as meritless, writing, "The defendant stands alone in American history for his alleged crimes. No other president has engaged in conspiracy and obstruction to overturn valid election results and illegitimately retain power." Donald Trump had previously claimed that because his attempt to influence the election failed, he shouldn't be accused of wrongdoing. However, special counsel Jack Smith's team countered, providing the analogy that robbers would still be charged even if they were captured en route to a bank robbery. They continued, "A conspiracy can be committed even if the object of the conspiracy is unattainable." Jack Smith also rejected Donald Trump's First Amendment defenses because he didn't just lie in saying the 2020 election was stolen, instead launching attacks at the proper function of the government process by blaming specific states like Georgia for counting dead non-resident, non-citizen or otherwise ineligible voters. The former president's lawyers have 10 days to reply before U.S. District Judge Tanya Chutkan makes a ruling on the dismissal motion. Trump's trial is set to begin on 4th of March. The British newspaper The Independent has also covered the same story. Prosecutors with Special Counsel Jack Smith's office are calling on Judge Tanya Chutkan to reject former President Donald Trump's efforts to have the election subversion and conspiracy charges against him dismissed, writing in a Monday, 6th of November court filing that Mr. Trump stands alone in American history for his alleged crimes, and pointing out that cases cited by the ex-president's lawyers don't support the arguments that they've made. No other president has engaged in conspiracy and obstruction to overturn valid election results and illegitimately retain power. The indictment squarely charges the defendant for his conduct, and the defendant's constitutional and statutory challenges to it are meritless. In the 79-page court filing opposing two separate motions filed by Mr. Trump's legal team, Assistant Special Counsels James Pierce, John Pelletieri, and Senior Assistant Special Counsels Thomas Windham and Molly Gaston noted that the indictment returned against the ex-president by a Washington, D.C. grand jury over the summer accused him of perpetrating an unprecedented campaign of deceit to attack the very functioning of the federal government to collect, count, and certify votes to obstruct the January 6th congressional proceeding at which the election results are certified and to disenfranchise millions of American voters. They further described Donald Trump's actions as part of a concerted criminal effort to overturn the presidential election results and prevent the lawful transfer of power to his successor.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Israel is launching fresh strikes on Gaza after killing more than 15,000 Palestinians, most of them women and children. Hamas resistance fighters say they have targeted Israeli cities with a barrage of missiles and hit gatherings of the occupation forces in northern parts of Gaza. Now, people around the world have held rallies to show solidarity with Palestinians and condemn the Israeli genocide in Gaza. Thank you for joining us. Israel has launched new attacks across the Gaza Strip a day after the end of a week-long ceasefire, leaving nearly 175 people dead.